This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Information when he had regular access to the material, and it was fully within his privileges as a intelligence analyst to have the information on his computer. And so that is why, as we're seeing in this court martial right now, the defense is pushing to get dismissed or to get a finding of not guilty on about half of the charges.
Kevin Gostala, civil liberties blogger at Fire Dog Lake. He's been covering Bradley Manning's trial at Fort Meade, Maryland, every day since it's begun. Kevin is the co-author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. The judge hearing the case against Private Bradley Manning at Fort Meade said she would decide Thursday on Manning's lawyer's request to dismiss seven of the charges, including allegations that he aided the enemy when he provided hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. You can go to democracynow.org to visit all our past coverage on Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks. Also go there to see our extended interviews with Glenn Greenwald, with Michael Ratner, the attorney for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and others. That's democracynow.org. You can also visit our Facebook page and tweet about us. Let your friends know about this independent, daily, unembedded, investigative, international news hour. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, Christian Goff, Vesta Gadars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Craig-Meadows, Rakan Penny, Carlo De Jesus. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, hosted by Joe Uris. Today's topic will be the science fiction world of his childhood versus the reality of today. It's about how it all came true and how awful it really is. Do you think it's awful or wonderful? Do call in and tell us.
Got to have food.
Do you eat? Tune into the Food Show on Wednesday to hear Dr. Marion Nessel, nutrition educator and author of Food Politics and numerous other books about food and nutrition. Also hear Jen Chapin talk about her new song, Feed Your Baby. That's the KBOO Food Show on the third Wednesday of every month at 11 a.m. right here on Community Radio, KBOO.
Oh, the future lies ahead. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Abe ain't here. It's just me, Joe. You can call us at 231-8187. I want to lighten things up a little bit. I mean, I'll talk about the heavy stuff if you want. I'll talk about Trayvon Martin being murdered by George Zimmerman, and I'll talk about the strange jury trial in Florida. I'll talk about the whole notion that comes out of the tradition of slavery in the South that basically says a black man on his own anywhere should be challenged by a white man and, if necessary, taken down. I talk about racism. I will spend time on it. I could even talk about everything from the Pentagon Papers to the WikiLeaks. And to Ellsberg, for example, or Bradley Manning, or any of those people. But today, because it's summer, And I just feel all kind of, you know, lying in the grass, reading Ray Bradbury, hanging out, feeling good, feeling all the kind of new feelings that you feel when you're a 12-year-old boy or girl in Southern California. I'm trying to set the scene for you. Southern California. I want to talk about an experience that I had then and what my insight into that experience is now. So it's Joe's psychoanalytic time, and I do want to tell you a story. When I was 12, we lived in the country, in a town you maybe some of you even have passed through or lived in, called Vista, which is in San Diego County, just on the other side of the line between Riverside and San Diego counties. A lovely town, really. Anyway, in that town, at that time, I fancied myself an oil painter. And I found an old shade, you know, an old window shade. And I thought, I'll make a mural. And the mural I had in mind and the drawings I did, which I wish I still had, were of Los Angeles in the past, sweet, sleepy Pueblo, right? That's the stereotype of my childhood. The city of then, which was, you know, which was just 1950s kind of busy, but still really kind of funky. It had trolleys. It had all the characteristics of an American growing big city of that era. Los Angeles center, downtown was still the center of the city. All of the buses and so on converged on the Union Station. The very large, but not so visible in those days, community of Chicanos, of Hispanics of various ethnicities and backgrounds, were there, but they were hidden. This is the era when Chavez Ravine in L.A., which had been promised to the Mexican-American community for housing, was in the process of being turned into the Dodger Stadium. So betrayals were underway of a multitude of kinds. But I was a kid, and I looked at the city at that time, and I decided my murals would be the sweet, sleepy Pueblo of L.A., the city of then, that is contemporary, 1952, okay? And the city of the future. The city of the future was dominated in my mind with Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and just really cool stuff and EC Comics series of kind of neat cartoon books, you know, comic books. And I was going to make these three murals on this piece of canvas from a window. Well, technology defeated me. I couldn't get the sizing, you know, the stuff that keeps the cloth stiff in a window shade, out of the material, and it wouldn't take paint. So I never did the mural. I did drawings. I don't know where they are now. They're long gone. But I had this idea, this fantasy city. And if you're at all an Angeleno or you know the city at all, you know that there used to be a funicular railroad. A little tiny, they used to call it the smallest railroad in the world, a little tiny railroad that went up the hill from downtown L.A., from the Grand Central Market, and from places like the Bradbury Building, and went up the hill, to the top of something called Bunker Hill. Bunker Hill was a neighborhood of old houses that had been turned into rooming houses and apartments, very old, beautiful architecture, but really funky at that time. Now that neighborhood has been cleared and has reemerged as the Disney Concert Hall, which is a beautiful modern building, the Museum of Modern Art for L.A. All these neat things are there, but at the same time, during those years, beginning about the time that I was nostalgizing for a future that did not yet, of course, exist, L.A. was growing rapidly. The freeway system was coming in. The light rail system of that time, the red cars, the Pacific Electric, was being disappeared. The whole politics of the region was turning toward gasoline-powered cars, absolutely, and the city was changing, but not yet had really changed. So, by the time I was a person in high school, the city had changed. And by the time I was out of high school, going to college and stuff, the city was completely changed. The trolley lines on the surface had disappeared. The Pacific Electric was long gone. The freeway system was established, multiple layers of cars zooming hither and yon. The smog was horrendous, but with beautiful sunsets, because there's nothing that makes a prettier sunset than particulates in the air. And it was just the beginning of something really much more terrifying than I could have imagined as a kid. Because what I imagined was a science fiction paradise. I didn't really imagine what would it be like to live in these high-rises of my mind that went up 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 stories with glass fronts. I didn't really imagine what it would be like to live in sealed-in buildings. I didn't really imagine what it would be like to be in that Los Angeles. And even at that point, I began to read science fiction, which began to see a dystopian world, a world in which human values, humanity as a concept, was disappearing or had disappeared. This was the world of the fascist Robert Heinlein, who was a very popular science fiction writer of that era. This was the world of the humanist Ray Bradbury, who was terrified of that future and predicted fairly accurately what a totalitarian American state would look like. All of that is kind of rolled into my memories of my desire, a very petty desire, to make a three-panel mural about the past, the present, and the future of Los Angeles. Well, the future is here. The future is here. And we can see in every city the pattern that I fantasized coming out of my experience with science fiction writers and the EC Comics and a whole bunch of other sources. Well, it's sad. It's sad and it's real. And it's something that challenges our humanity and challenges our future, not just in the United States, but in Mumbai, you know, and in New York, of course, and in England and all over the world. This future of the decrease in humanism, the decrease in humanity and the potential for caring. It was a cruel world then. It was a cruel world in the past of then. And it's an even crueler world now because we have managed to disassociate ourselves from the horrendous, murderous violence of a powerful nation state. We've achieved the ultimate weapon systems. We have drones doing the dirty work for us in our imperial game all over the world. We are the science fiction world that I fantasized in a positive mode, but it's dreadful. It's polluted. It's nasty. Coal trains are coming. They're going to be running, if we don't stop them, running down the gorge, poisoning our atmosphere. The coal will be shipped to China and other parts of Asia. The coal will be turned into electrical power. The fumes and the poisons, the mercury and the lead and all the other particulate matter that's in the coal will be drifting into the atmosphere and coming back to us here in the United States, poisoning our children and our children's children, but the sunsets will be very beautiful. So, what I would like to do today is something very different from our normal shows and very different from my, you know, I thought, oh, I'll talk about Trayvon Martin and I'll talk about George Zimmerman, but you know about that. You know about the treatment of black men in the South. You know about the treatment in general of minorities in the United States. You know about the injustices that are involved. So, yeah, we can talk about that. We can talk about Bradley Manning. We can talk about Snowden. We can talk about the WikiLeaks. We can talk about the implications of a nation state that can't handle its own secrets. Okay. But before we do that, and instead of doing that today, let's talk about the future. Let's talk about what you thought the world would be like and how you see the world today. Are you willing to play along with me on this? It's a different kind of show, but hey, why not? It's summer. The skies are mildly polluted. The atmosphere is growing warmer all the time. The reservoirs are going to be covered. You know, it's kind of getting to the place where I was at in 1952 here in Portland, Oregon. So, can we do that? Can we play this game? And I need you to play along. I need you to tell me what you think, what you thought when you were a kid the future would be like, and what you think it's going to be like today, and what you think today is like today. I think this is important. I think it's fun. I think it makes for interesting conversation. And I want you to join me. 231-8187. And I'll kill the time till you've thought through what you want to say, and I'll tell you stuff that won't make you happy about contemporary events. Because you know what? It's not a happy environment. It's not a happy world. It's not a happy government. It's not. It's not. It's not what we had hoped, most of us, and it is very much what it is. So let's hear from you, okay? 231-8187. Okay, well, to begin with, let's understand the kind of science fiction world that I was experiencing as a preteen. It really was a grand scheme, vast roadways through the sky, kind of like the movie Metropolis from the 1920s. Huge helicopters taking off and landing, huge cars, comfortable wagons of delight, a world that was highly mechanized, highly scientific, whatever the hell that meant, and a world in which there were no, this is important, because there were no trees. We didn't imagine trees. I didn't imagine trees as part of my cityscape. From standing at the top of Bunker Hill, looking across the city as a contemporary, when the beautiful old Art Deco Richfield building was still there, when in general L.A. was still a funky old city, when the Bradbury building was not atypical, when the city of Los Angeles was a city of the past already and quickly changing. So what's the future for you? What were your dreams? What is your reality? How do you see things going? 231-8187. Story, you're on the air.
Well, can you hear me?
I can.
All right. I'm a contemporary of yours. Actually, I'm a little older.
But okay.
You remember Chomsky's remark, the media is psychopathically upbeat?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you know, that actually is a trait of the human psyche. Our brain. Now, I'm staying with the.
No. Go ahead. Problem. Go ahead. You're doing fine.
Yeah. The lesson of evolution is that calories are hard to obtain. That's why we store them so readily as fat.
Yeah.
And our brain. If a psyche tries to avoid anxiety. So we're always prone to the rosier picture.
Yeah, I said, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, right?
Well, coloring it differently because our brain is our huge neocortex is a gas hog. Okay,
I gotcha.
It burns calories, and so our psyche tries to avoid anxiety. So this is science. It's going to always trip toward the upbeat message. The most promising message, because again, our brain consumes our oversized gas hog brain consumes too many calories. And I'll make I'll make it quick. Our brain works by digesting sensory input into concepts. Are you following me?
Yes.
Okay. Doing that, it can conceive such things as linear time, the past, the present, the future.
Right.
And because we can anticipate all kinds of apprehensions about the future in the future, I mean, about, you know, events in the future.
Right.
We could eat up all available calories in anxiety. But that's why we create things like, a God that can be cajoled to intervene on our behalf against forces that are... You know, we have no power over.
Right.
So there we are. My point being that our future is our past, because humans haven't changed.
Okay, I appreciate the insight, man. And it's
maybe
interesting. I mean, your point about the physiology of it is quite interesting.
Well, that's again, I mean, we take the worst case scenarios. You know, as the Allies were closing in on Germany, you know, the preponderant number of Germans were still believing that there was going to be a miracle super weapon that was going to change everything. So anyway, I'll let it go at that. Have fun.
Hey, thanks for the call. Bye. All right. If you're just tuning in, this is, of course, KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe isn't here. It's just me, Joe, and I'm kind of nostalging, engaging in a summertime thought about a mural that I never really made, the drawings for which I did create and have long since been lost, imagining Los Angeles from the top of Bunker Hill, which is where the Disney Museum is now and the Modern Art Museum is now, which was then rooming houses of old kind of mansions. And there was a funicular railroad that ran from downtown proper up to Bunker Hill in those days. And just imagining the city, looking across the cityscape from the past, a small pueblo of quaint Hispanic community, the present of that time with buildings that were richly Art Deco and that it was a real city center in Los Angeles. Freeway system was not yet in place. And then looking to a future like the movie Metropolis, multiple layers of highway, huge buildings, vast sheets of glass, and horrendous pollution, which I didn't think of then. Well, that world, that fantasy world, that technologically rich environment has come to pass, and Los Angeles is the archetype of it. So here we are talking about now and how it is and what is the future of now going to be. It's a kind of an intellectual game. It's fun to play. Your imagination gets to work on it. I would like to do this conversation for the rest of the hour. Will you help me? 231-8187. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I feel pretty good about the future.
Okay.
I think I see trends in myself. I'm 40 years old. I see myself falling into those kids and their damn rock and roll. you know, like my grandpa thought about my dad, and I, you know, now I see my dad. It's all going to hell in a handbasket. But I have a younger brother. He's 10 years younger, and I work with people a lot younger than myself.
Uh-huh.
And they see the world. They see the world very positively. And I see trends with them. For instance, like my little brother, you know, he might have a girlfriend, and, you know, when he brings her home, we find out she's from Korea. He mm-hmm. doesn't even announce that she's from Korea, like even my generation. Oh, yeah, I met this nice girl, or, you know, she's Korean.
So the kind of racist assumptions of the past are gone.
Well, I think with some of our youth, and, you know, we were in Oklahoma at the time, but, you know, my brother, he just didn't consider to even mention that. That didn't even occur to him. So I think that's really neat.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think that's how it ought to be. One ought to describe one's companion in terms of the qualities of the companion, not the ethnic background.
I think we're, you know, the future that I saw, and I was a huge sci-fi fan growing up. And, you know, it was colored. You know, we had our Blade Runners, too. You know, we had our dark painted futures.
Right.
But I think what we're looking for in the future, or what part of that fantasy is, are massive technological leaps. And I think we've mastered a lot of the basics, and I think the big technological leaps are requiring trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars to get there, super colliders and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we'll have a big leap. We'll have a big leap coming. It's a little slower. It's a little slower to the gate than maybe we were hoping, or the picture that was painted to us about the year 2000 when we were young.
Well, what do you think about personal freedom? What I call humanity, the sense of place, the sense of a relationship between humans and nature. How do you think that'll be? Let's say 50 or 100 years from now.
I think we're good people. I think we're compulsive, but I think we need that technological leap to put ourselves on a good path. We're not going to shed electricity. And I think people love to, you know, live a hippie lifestyle and go do yoga. Heck, I love yoga too.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, when your kid falls out of a tree and he's got a compound fracture, yeah, you want that ambulance picking him up, and you want surgeons like reconnecting his leg. So I don't think we want to let go of those things.
Uh-huh.
I think it's largely about our ability to recycle and our we just consume too much. So I think if we can get a handle on that, if we can get a limitless power source, if we can get, like I said, a better balance through our recycling of what we eat and what we drink, I think we'll probably be in good shape. And I think there's a lot of money to be made in those sectors. I think we're going to see a lot of investment. We're already seeing a lot of investment in those sectors.
Well,
and I think 50 to 100 years, I think we'll be in good shape.
I think that's interesting. I really appreciate your call. Let's see what some other folks think. 231-8187, we're talking about, well, here it is. What do we know about now? What do we think about the future based on what we knew about the past, the present, and the future? All of this is derived from my childhood fantasy of building a mural of Los Angeles City Center from Bunker Hill, which probably most of you never even heard of. What the heck? And we just had a caller who talked about a potential for some kind of, super limitless power source, maybe tapping into the sun or something. I don't know. Well, let's hear what you think about the future. What do you think about the future of humanity? 231-8187. Sean, you're on the air.
Wow. I'm roughly the same age as that last guy, and I want to smoke some of what he's smoking.
Well, it's almost legal.
This is the 300th anniversary of Machiavelli's The Prince.
Really?
And I think...
I did not know that.
Yeah, this year is 300 years since The Prince was published, and I think that's kind of appropriate. 22 years ago, right around the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, I guess November of 1989,
mm-hmm.
I remember thinking at the time, wow, you know, it won't be long and the entire world will look like Scandinavia. You know, we'll have this wonderfully balanced, kind of generous welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be individual liberties and personal freedoms combined with a very generous, standard of living.
Yeah.
And instead of moving towards the Scandinavian model, the model seems to be Colombia. You know, gated communities with high rates of murder and violence. What came to mind was this quote from 1984. I'll read it very quickly here.
Sure, go ahead.
But always, and do not forget this, Winston, always there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. It seems like that's the world that I see. I don't know where that last guy was coming from. I see, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, life becoming more coarse and vulgar and degraded. And Derek Jensen seems to be a little bit more on the right track than, that whatever that last guy was thinking of. But
well, that's I think that, we're talking speculative. It's like speculative fiction here, science fiction.
Sure.
We're talking about a number of possibilities. Every moment, of course, branches into possible future moments. But I'm more like you. I think we are a friendly fascist state.
Yep.
And an imperial state. And I think we're heading for a disastrous comeuppance as the rest of the world gains the power to challenge us. But I also think that since you mentioned 1984, that Orwell's idea of perpetual war as a way to unify the people with a vague enemy overseas that we don't know anything about is a pretty accurate summation of where we're going.
Well, sure. And then also if you look at mass incarceration, if you look at, the division between the haves and the have-nots, and just the daily sensation of humiliation that leaves a huge segment of the population. Every morning when they wake up, they have this overwhelming sense of humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
That, my children aren't as valuable as that other person's children. Their schools, their neighborhoods, everything will be substandard while this other person's life will be enhanced and their children will have everything.
Which so essentially
people with a constant prevailing sense of humiliation on it.
So you're suggesting that the class structure will become more harshly defined. The haves will be a smaller but richer number of people, and the have nots will be almost everybody else with a lot of notions about their equality, which is not borne out by the reality of their lives.
Sure. I get, Colombia, I can't think of it. Maybe India, Colombia, something like that,
I appreciate your insight, and I think it definitely is probably more toward my dark future, but
okay.
Who knows? Listen,
hey, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, one thing I would like to ask of all you folks calling in is, well, I don't want to discourage people who are of the male persuasion, but I'd like to hear some more, some women. One of the biggest problems with talk radio as a medium is that it tends to draw men. This is a demographic fact of talk radio. However, I would, if anybody has an investment in the future, it's got to be women. So I'd like to hear from women if they feel like calling in and talking about the future. Remember that I'm talking about my memories from a current Los Angeles previous to the one we are all familiar with. It's 1952 Los Angeles, a past of a sleepy Pueblo, a stereotype born out of the kind of racism that was part of my California youth, and a future like the future that we, some of us, feel is there in L.A. and coming here all the time. So let's hear from you, 231-8187. Mark, you're on the air.
It's Barth. Good morning,
Mark,
Joe.
Mark, sorry. Yeah.
Not a problem. I always had this idea that you were more of an East Coast guy than a West Coast guy.
Well, I've lived in a lot of places. Let's just put it that way.
Fair enough. I grew up in Cleveland, in the suburbs, older, mostly white suburbs of Cleveland. And I come from a big family, and, you know, our worldview as it unfolded was, you know, great big trees, big old houses, generally friendly neighbors. You know, we'd watch Disney, we'd see the fish leaping up the rivers and the bears eating them. You know, that was just, that was almost an unbelievable scenario. You know, mm-hmm. How can stuff like this exist? Because there wasn't, it wasn't a terrible place, but we didn't get a lot of exposure to nature on a daily basis, except for, you know, green grass and big trees. There were parks, you know, there were swimming pools. We got around a little bit, and our family took driving trips, you know, so we went to Niagara Falls, we went to Pennsylvania and fed the fish. We went around the country, you know.
What's it like to feed a fish?
You
don't need to respond to that.
There are impoundments in Pennsylvania where you would buy loaves of white bread and throw them in, and you would have a maelstrom of fishes, you know, coming to eat this stuff. I mean, hundreds and thousands of them just breaking the surface. It was nuts. But as I got to be a teenager and had a wider exposure to the, you know, that was the mid-60s for me,
mm-hmm.
and the late 60s, you know, I got an exposure to the blooming counterculture and a wider worldview of ideally more equality, mm-hmm. and mutual support of rampant distrust of government, of the idea of nonconformity being okay, being a valid stance, versus my sixth grade teacher saying to all of us boys, well, you know, when you want to go into business, the first thing you have to do is go out and get a good hat. you know, the it's almost unbelievable how much the world view changed between the people of the Depression and the growing up through the World War II and the generations that came just after, you know, born after Korea, or, you know, were children of the Korean War era, and the boomers, you know, who of course came up from there. And so the world looked like a different place. It looked like there was possibilities for bulk happiness and cooperation.
What do you think now? What do you think about now? Now, what do you think of the future now?
What do I think of the future now? Well, it's complicated. I think that, you know, I'm terribly alarmed in many ways about the crashes of the ice shelves and the melting of the poles. I'm terribly concerned about the carbon content of the atmosphere, mm-hmm. which is definitely related, but also of the uranium fission byproducts that are circulating in the ocean from Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big deal, and it doesn't get much ink. I'm worried that the huge imbalances that we have, you know, we've always had imbalances between the rich and the poor, but the huge polarizing effect of that, and the, you know, the tendency toward the poor being in the worst places, much more toxic exposure, much less access to medical care, or even, you know, decent food. And I kind of see the areas that are going to remain natural as being kind of enclaves for the rich, and you know, that the rich are going to have the medical care, and that the rest of us, and I'm including myself, you know, are going to be the victims of the environmental crash and are going to be the ones that are suffering. I would like to be more optimistic. You know, you ask for women callers, and I'd encourage that as well, but I have three daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, the world is changing so fast. You know, I was thinking optimistically when I was young that, you know, the older work model of, you know, being in a long-term job and having a decent retirement and you know, being able to travel around the country in my dotage and see my extended family members without a great deal of stress was going to be part of my lot. I love old architecture and cities, and I also love natural places, and I thought that I would be able to tour the world. I'd be able to go see Paris. I'd be able to go back to Ireland one more time and you know, just see things that are truly a supplement to my present by being part of my past.
That's an interesting way to put it, and I do appreciate that. I want to give some others an opportunity, though.
Fair enough. I think it's a great topic.
No, and I really appreciate your comments. By the way, I think everyone today has been very interesting. Thank you very much for the call.
Bye.
I do want to once again emphasize the grim reality of talk. I don't know if it's so grim, but we don't get a lot of female callers, and I really wish we had more exchange involving women. But it's, you know, it is what it is, as they say. I got to make some announcements here. I got to tell you what's coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9 on Alternative Radio, economist and professor Richard Wolff speaks on democracy at work. At 10, Chris Andre hosts the Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an in-depth discussion with Makani Temba, founder of the Praxis Project, on the not guilty verdict of George Zimmerman, and also of the George Zimmerman trial. Also, we have a report on the boycott of companies that do business in Israel. At 11 on stage and studio, host Dime Roberts speaks with filmmaker Cynthia Lopez and Hueve Hall about their project. I hope I'm not butchering these names. Speaking with women, roller derby. I loved roller derby on TV when I was a kid. Roller derby players around the world and their new film in progress, Flat Track Around the World. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Galaban interviews Danielle Knapp, associate curator of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum at the University of Oregon, about current shows there, including new American acquisitions. And I want to thank KBOO members for their generous support. And I want to say, listen, I know a lot of you listen. I know you listen to KBOO and you don't give money. Well, the reality is that money becomes a very serious driving force in the survival of this station. So it's time to plunk it up, $40, $60, whatever you can afford, to make this station thrive, not just survive. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOFM on your computer and clicking on Donate Today. All right, 231-8187. We're talking about my nostalgic trip to when I was 12, to a mural I made about Los Angeles in the past, Los Angeles in the present of 1952, and the current Los Angeles, using that as a model of how I perceived as a child the world of the future and what the real world of the future seems more and more like. By the way, the images I had of the future were horribly, I thought they were wonderful. I thought that was very exciting, but they're horribly true now. Layers of freeway, of fantastic sunsets, strange giant buildings, all that stuff that I thought was so cool is here, and boy, is it scary. Let's hear from you, 231-8187. Steve, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe. Hey, listen, you ought to give a shout-out to Ursula K. Le Guin and all of her fans.
I really appreciate that. In fact, I think Ursula Le Guin is one of the best writers around.
Yeah, and she had a lot to say about dystopian futures. And
But anyway,
her and Andre Norton. But I wanted to talk about some older, mention some older science fiction works. We by Yevgeny Zamyatin.
Uh-huh.
Inspired 1984 by George Orwell. And his view is interesting. He was a naval engineer, and he worked both in Britain and in the Soviet Union. And he wrote We as a protest, kind of, against the technological world, whether it was in the West or in the East Bloc. And for that, he got kicked out of the Soviet Union.
He's lucky he got kicked out. They could have disappeared him. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, it was still early in, under Lenin, and they were nice to him.
Okay.
So they allowed him to emigrate. But the other one is interesting. It's a Czech author. He wrote R.U.R., Rasum's Universal Robots.
Mm-hmm.
It was a play in the 20s talking about the technological world where, you know, the robots are created and they replace humans, and then they go amok and they kill all the humans except for one.
Ah.
But he was examining this. Rasum is the Czech for reason. In other words, he's saying this is the technological end of reason, where reason, you know, this rationality, this hyper rationality, replaces other human values.
No, I think that's, keep talking, but I did want to insert here that I see in looking at science fiction all through the years, to the degree I've read a lot of it, some of it, and I understand that one of the most frequent themes in that literature, and much of it written by very bright people, is dystopian. That is, it's not a nice future. It's a dreadful, mechanized, dehumanized, and perhaps destructive to humankind future. Anyway, go ahead with what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Another work that he did was War of the Newts, which was...
I love War of the Newts! War of the Newts, in which the newts win!
Yeah, the newts win, and everybody is selling themselves out to the destruction of the newts because they're making money.
Mm-hmm.
Because the newts are giving them gold that they're getting from the ocean, and everybody, for the sake of this gold, is selling themselves out to be destroyed. Interesting story. That the thing which they thought were going to be their slaves wind up being their masters. I wanted to bring out an interesting point. The word technology, it's interesting. It comes from the word technos in Greek. And it doesn't mean a creation or a work or anything like that. What technos means is a child, which is an interesting thing. That technology would come from the Greek word for a child, you know, like, you know.
I know nothing of this.
What's that?
I say I know nothing of that.
Yeah, and so I got to thinking of this, and, you know, I'll give a disclaimer. I'm a Christian. I read the Bible, and I started thinking completely different about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea was that, you know, men were you know, made in the image of God, and so, you know, a child was, you know, made in the image of his father. Well, technology is in the image of man. It's his child. You know, it's not nature. In fact, it's designed to destroy or control nature, to put a buffer, a medium between nature and man, controlling even human nature. Even to control human nature, that's too much, you know, wrong. That's too much out of control. And there's a thing in the 70s where the people who think that we have a future, there were two sustainable houses created in the as projects, one in America, one in Sweden, in the 70s. and it was called the House of the Home of the Future.
Mm-hmm.
And the American one had an exclamation point at the end of it. The Swedish one had a question mark.
Uh-huh.
And so the Swedish guy was an architect, and he retrofitted a two-bedroom trailer in sunny Sweden, you know, solar-powered, recycled, you know, water, you know, condensed and stuff, compostable garbage, you know, the greenhouse. It, you could live in there. You could support yourself off the grid in this
uh-huh.
house.
Uh-huh.
And it cost $60,000 back in the 70s. Which, you know, that's a considerable amount back then, but compared to the $3 million for the computerized, sprawling three-bedroom ranch house that was built in California with all the active solar panels and this and the constant glitches and outages, it basically was saying, you know, we could do this for $3 million, but it's really a joke and it really wouldn't work, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that had the exclamation point, is this is the way we've got to go, this high-tech thing, where the Swedish guy is saying, if you're willing to live quite a bit simpler, yeah, you can live off the grid, you could support yourself, you could have this liberty. But there was a question mark, and the question mark is not whether it can be technologically done. It can be. It's the will to step back from technology, actually. You know, the Amish don't have cars, and
right.
the reason they don't have cars is that when cars first came out, they debate the effects of technology on their community. So some of them don't even have buttons. And the idea of that is, you know, they go back to the 16th century, right? So
yeah, I think they have buttons, but not zippers. But anyway.
Well, yeah. And well, some of them don't even have buttons. They
really?
Have crochet hooks and
oh, okay, know. Okay.
But the reason is, they say, you know, one day if we become dependent on this technology, the world may ask a price that we should not be willing to pay. And so when cars came out, they debated, well, what effect will this technology have on our communities? And the reason they rejected cars was that, you know, if we get cars, then people are going to be feel free to just move far away from the community. They won't be involved with the community anymore, and it's going to weaken us. It's going to destroy the community. And they said, for this reason, we won't have cars. But they made a decision, you know, and I've seen that in a church where a church was trying to come together and several people had to commute like an hour to get there, and they stopped going. It was just too much.
Mm-hmm.
So this trumps what they say are their most important values. It prevents even the formation of a community unless you're willing to step back from the technology. And
well, I think that's a very interesting point. So if I understand what you're arguing that technology is itself a device that creates inhumanity.
Well, yes.
Or has the potential to do that.
You know, I mentioned looking at the Bible, and what I saw was that all the blessings of civilization came through Cain.
Ah.
It specifically lists all of these foundations of civilization and technology is coming from Cain, the murderer. And I looked at this thing about the curse on mankind. It says, you know, cursed is the earth for your sake. It'll bring nothing but thorns and thistles, and you're going to live by the sweat of your brow. I've had to do hard manual labor in my life, and when I worked, I sweat all over. I didn't sweat on my brow. Sweating on your brow is, you know, we use the expression, don't sweat it, and that's what we mean. We mean you're living by anxiety, and the sweat's coming out of your brow, not the rest of you. And that's what it means, is that from then on, man looked at nature as an enemy, as something that's always in his way, always producing red ink.
Well, I think what you're saying is very interesting, and I think and don't be insulted, but I think the Christian mythology does address a lot of these issues, and I appreciate your call, but I do want to give some others an opportunity. So thank you very much for the call. All right, 231-8187. We're talking about dystopias. We're building this conversation on my memory of trying to make a mural of the of Los Angeles in the past, the then present of 1952, and the future, which is, in the terms of my memory of this mural, would be what LA is like today. All of it viewed from Bunker Hill, which you probably most of you have never even heard of. All right, 231-8187. Who do we got? Harvey.
Well, I believe the society will break down into three groups: high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech.
High-tech, low-tech, and no-tech?
Yes, and That's it, you know. I mean, people will sort themselves out on those levels, whichever they're feeling comfortable on or thrust into.
Let me just bring up something here. I noticed that a lot of the conversation veers toward the impacts of technology one way or the other, or absence thereof. But what about the notion of humanity? What about the notions of ethics and right living ecological living, being within an environment that is self-sustaining and that we are simply part of? Do you see anything like that possible?
Yes, I do. I see. Well, now we live in the world of quantum entanglement, and entanglement is the way we're going. Like, for instance, Facebook. Facebook is about entanglement. People want to entangle with each other, and it's one of the largest websites on the planet today. Mm-hmm. And I feel also that the NSA reaction of telling us they're listening to our phone calls, reading our emails, is a reaction to the entanglement. In a sense, they've lost control. You know, as I mentioned in the past, a woman in Texas decided to fight Monsanto. She wanted to make sure they're labeling. She put up a website, and a week later, millions of people were marching around the world, the march on against Monsanto. And in Syria and Egypt, the governments that have always controlled the media and the people, they've lost control. We're entangling on a worldwide level, and I see that as the X factor. And the internet, you know, we're coming up to, we're 7 billion people, but if you think of it as a large brain, it's a brain composed of 7 billion parts moving toward 8 or 9 billion parts, and that's going to just create even more entanglement and create the X factor. At the same time, we're birthing other life forms. We're a carbon-based life form, and we're birthing artificial intelligence, which is silicon-based life form. So I expect also to our entanglement will lead to the universe will be connecting, I believe, with other beings from other planets. The thing is that we're the UFO on Mars. We're at the bottom of the ocean taking samples. We're already in space. But at the same time, it's not a pretty picture because everything is happening all at once, all the time. And so it's the good and the bad. But I believe that we're moving from adolescence to adulthood as our population grows, and I see a bright future.
Thank you very much. And that's an interesting argument, and it's a very positive one in contrast to a lot of us right here, right now. Thank you for the call, man.
Thank you.
All right, 2318187. He mentioned the concept of childhood's end. C. Arthur Clarke, or is it Arthur C. Clarke? I can't remember. The science fiction writer of a long time ago, British, very bright, wrote a book about essentially visitors from another planet who are on the task of taking the children of America and of the world and delivering them to a new world because they now are old enough, more mature, more brilliant, and ready for such a move. A bittersweet novel and an interesting one, which I would recommend. 2318187. We're talking about dystopias, the future, and my memory. Okay, who we got? Boris.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I wanted to relate my comment also to Arthur C. Clarke, and specifically his story, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Right, good point. That is a very popular movie.
Well, yes, you may remember that there was quite a public response when that movie first came out. I remember hearing about people who had no interest at all in science fiction that were just driven to go see the movie. So,
right,
interesting. But a brief aside, I've always enjoyed stories, comments over the years of listening to Kabu. I always look forward when I hear his name to hear what he has to say. So back to my own experience, thinking back on my childhood, I don't recall really thinking too much about the future other than brief things like, you know, TV shows or something like that. But when I went to see the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, there was a particular scene in that movie that hit me like a sledgehammer, and that was the scene with the apes being influenced by the monolith, if you recall.
Yes.
And all of a sudden picking up bones and realizing that there was potential for tool use and all of that sort of thing. And it had such an impact on me that I couldn't stop thinking about it. And over time, I developed, based on Kubrick's on Clark's supposition that, you know, human evolution on the planet was basically an experiment that was being influenced from beyond the planet.
Yes.
The more I thought about that, the more I came to the conclusion that humanity on the planet Earth is an experiment gone bad. And
okay.
The reason that I came to that conclusion is because all my life I've been very connected to the natural world. It's been my solace and my nourishment. And I saw the direction that we were headed, humanity, you know, basically wanting to manipulate and monopolize whatever nature could offer. And it left me with a very negative impression of where we were headed. And it was all really based on that one scene that I saw in 2001.
Well, that's really interesting. The combination of Kubrick's filmmaking and Clark's idea of the future was a powerful and very compelling product. And it did indeed, the discovery of the use of a bone as a tool, of course, the primary tool would then be a weapon, is a kind of a nice metaphor for the development of humankind. And I appreciate your call. The image that was created in that movie really is dystopian. So anyway, thank you very much. We'll get some other folks on.
Thank you.
Yeah, 231-8187. This is a very interesting conversation, very different than our usual shows. We mostly go after the disgusting patterns and problems of the United States and the world right now. Right now, on the other hand, right now, on this program, we're kind of examining a dystopian and utopian ideas based on kind of my memory of a mural I never made of Los Angeles from Bunker Hill, a place you probably never heard of, where now the Disney Concert Hall and the Museum of Modern Art are located, but was once rooming houses and old mansions with a funicular railroad that went from the center of downtown right up to the top of the hill, which were very close to each other. An idea of the stereotypical sleepy Mexican Pueblo, the then contemporary 1952 LA with a lot of Art Deco buildings and so on, which have all been torn down, and a future with multiple layer freeways, high speed this and high speed that, and a huge glass encased buildings. A future that I thought then at the age of 12 would be really cool. I now look at it very critically and see where humanity has somehow been driven away from the whole project of human development. All right, let's hear from you. 231-8187. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi. I was hoping to kind of offer something between the utopian and dystopian perspectives.
Sure.
I kind of grew up with my sci-fi was like The Matrix. I had a computer in my home. Mm-hmm. And so my perspective, I guess, on history has been that it's been very cyclical. A lot of nation states and stuff rising to power, becoming corrupt, falling, and that we just keep going through this pattern. And the only thing that's been moving forward really has been technology, as I see it. And it seems to be increasing in pace in that way. And one of your previous callers actually touched on this. I believe that perhaps like the internet or some other machine consciousness will emerge. And I think that will be our best shot at averting a sort of dystopian future, because we will be forced to interact with something completely new that hasn't been anywhere in human history whatsoever.
Well, that's really interesting.
I don't know if that'd be good or bad.
Yeah.
But I think that will be, at the very least, the biggest change we will ever see and our biggest shot.
Okay, well,
something great.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, and I appreciate the call. Let's go to, I think we have time for another caller. 231-81. Oh, Mark, go ahead.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for a great program.
Sure.
I come from a philosophical, theological, or contemplative tradition, which is very different from linear thinking. Unlike a chair, an idea can be shared by a whole people. Thinking is the best way to travel. I think that was a song from...
yeah, it is.
Traffic.
Right.
Well, I think it's vital for us to gain new understandings of work and success and power and health and happiness.
And now, unfortunately, I'm sorry, we're out of time, and I do appreciate all the calls, and I appreciate your call. I wish we had a little more time to talk about what you're talking about. But I'll be back. You stay tuned to KBOO, because it deals with the issues that really matter, and this may not be them. Okay, so long. See you next week. From those
It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
On Friday, July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., tune in for KBOO's one-day flash drive fundraiser, a day filled with news and music from the equator to Antarctica.
Lecture topics will include climate change, gay rights, and an overview of African land grabs. Don't miss out on the chance to explore underrepresented music and news from across the Southern Hemisphere on July 19th from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6 p.m. to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, economist and professor Richard Wolff speaks on democracy at work. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an in-depth discussion with Makani Temba, founder of the Praxis Project, on the not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman trial. Also, we'll have a report on the boycott of companies that do business in Israel. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host D-May Roberts speaks with filmmakers Cynthia Lopez and Juvie Hall about their project, speaking with women roller derby players around the world and their new film in progress, Flat Track Around the World. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Danielle Knapp, associate curator of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum at the University of Oregon, about current shows there, including new American acquisitions. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.